Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Excuse me. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Limelock, which, as you guys know from years and years, is the gathering of the curious radio amateurs who want to know more about how wireless equipment works. We've got a somewhat interesting program tonight, an interesting program in that Roy has a puzzle that's going to blow your mind. You won't believe what the answer is as to what's the closest planet to the Earth out there. Also, you're going to have a beautiful presentation by Paul. He's got a photograph that, if you get a chance to see it, it's a real mind-blowing photograph of the piece of hardware that's going to get them there, something you've never seen before, at least I've never seen before. I don't know, I'm going to be asking Paul if we need any extra time tonight for the presentation he's going to make. In fact, Paul, if you're there, give me a quick break on that. Will you need some extra time tonight? I didn't get a chance to see my last emails in the last 5 minutes. WS2N, K2LAW.
WS2N. No problem, Dick. Well, you'll see it on the email. Not a problem. You know, whatever I have. If there's anything left over, it always goes to the following week anyway. So we'll be okay. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Bear in mind that you can ask for extra time if you think you need it during any weather nets. And we can even switch the order of things. So, people sign into the TechNet by giving the three guys, Paul, Roy, and Dick, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you have a question or a comment for the net. The first half of the net, the first third of the net is where we take people who check in because they do have a question or a comment. And that section can last anything from half an hour to 2 hours, depending on how many comments and questions there are and how much enthusiasm. The whole system is variable, as you can tell. There's no such thing as a dumb question, so please ask questions. And when Roy comes along, make sure you give him participation. He likes people to give him answers. Even dumb answers are good answers, if you know what I mean. We've already got WA2S. Why, what? We got Roy. I mean, we got WRYY. Can't even read my own writing here. Joe is checked in. Anyone else who has a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Okay, we've got Joe. Rich number one is GXM. B2GXM, I think it is. And Rich number two is N2EO. Okay. And we're also checking because you do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. There's got to be at least one more guy out there. Checking on 975-375. Looks like we've got that. I hopefully, anybody would let me know right away if we didn't have EchoLink. EchoLink, IRLP, chat room. Boy, are there ways people can get a hold of this particular crew? So, anyone else with a check-in with call letters and name? Even if you've got a dumb question, don't worry about it. People like Charlie. Charlie knows who he is. He hasn't checked in for many years. Hope Charlie's going to check in one of these days. K2RIW listening for the next check-in.
K2GJE, does anyone know anything about over-the-air 9? Over.
Mr. GJE didn't give us a name, and he's asking a question about over-the-air 9. I'm not sure what that means. Give us your name and tell us what the word OPA9 means, sir.
Ed, K2GJE. The handle is Ed. I was receiving Channel 9 over the air, but I have not. Last couple of weeks, did they move or are they off the air? Over.
Okay. I have been watching 9-1, 9-3, and 9-4. As of this morning, for instance, or at least for the last few days, 9-2 went off the air. So 9-1, 9-3, and 9-4 are there. on 9-4. I like watching them during the week where they've got at 8 o'clock at night. Is it? Yeah, 8 o'clock at night. They've got Star Trek: The Original Series. And from 8 o'clock on to the next 3 or 4 hours, they've got Star Trek. So I've been watching them. They're on the air. Maybe your particular converter, Ed, is looking for 9-2 and 9-1. So you got 9-1, 9-3, and 9-4. So they're there. Okay, I'm going to go over to Joe, W2RYY. Go easy with us tonight, Joe. Sometimes you ask some pretty tough questions. That's a joke. Be as tough as you like. W2RYY, T2RYW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. W2RYY. I'll put my question out there in a moment, which is actually related to the 60 Minutes. So you just got done watching, because I know you watched 60 Minutes. But one comment. The only thing I know is that 9-4 is they changed the aspect ratio of the picture. But I don't think that would prevent him from viewing it. It used to be something you could change, or I could change, or I could run it to a letterbox or other forms. You can't do that anymore. It's locked at one aspect ratio. So here goes my question. You watch 60 Minutes tonight, because I know you love 60 Minutes, and the first 15 to 20 minutes is on these people who claim that they were getting bombarded by something which one guy says is possibly microwave energy. And some of these people claim they heard sounds when this stuff happened, besides getting headaches and so forth. So I wonder if you could just elaborate on that and think of, if RF is actually capable of doing something like that, even at some sort of distance away, using a very high power microwave beam with a high gain antenna and so forth. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Pulses of microwave energy are definitely capable of making what the human being will perceive as sound. That was done at L-band way back 1960 or so. I'm having trouble thinking of the name of the guy who was an airborne employee who did that experiment, and it got written up into the AIL record. There is a modern-day weaponized system by the United States government which uses 94 gigahertz and a great big phased array. And that can give you all kinds of high power energy delivered to a group of people that you want them to, you want to break up the crowd, so to speak, and you aim this weapon at them. I have the impression that that particular weapon is only good for some number of hundreds and maybe a thousand feet of range, but it can create a feeling of heat, sounds, and so on. At first you would say that this 60 Minutes report that was on tonight, the first 15 or 20 minutes that Joe said, let me drop. You could say that these various people in these various embassies are getting a psychosomatic effect. But when you get that number of people in that number of locations, in that many floors of a building and whatever, all of a sudden you can't, and that many people with that many illnesses, if anybody has not seen the first section of 60 Minutes program tonight, March 17th at 6 o'clock, no, 7 o'clock, 7 o'clock it went on, I think there's a way that you can go to CBS and play that back into your television, into your computer. You want to see that. Let me drop. From my point of view, it's a very well done presentation. They didn't make it overly dramatic. They didn't hype it. They just told you what they found, what the people are reporting, what various physicians and microwave experts say the symptoms are. So it could be very well, this could really be real. My question is, what are these individual countries and embassies, what is the motivation? Are they trying to make all of our people there sick and make them go away? How do you gain from doing that? So what's the real motivation for all these countries doing that, if that's what's really going on? So is it possible? Yes. That's part of what you're saying. Can microwave energy, when exposed to a human being at certain levels, generate sound or what you think is sound? Yes, it can. So I think that's some of the questions you were asking, Joe. And that's an exciting presentation by 60 Minutes. Maybe one of the best ones they've ever done. The B2LYY, T2LIW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, very good. What is L-band? You mentioned that, because sometimes people don't understand what those bands mean. I have an idea. It's probably related to what the frequency you said, but just what is L-band, number one? And how, the second thing was, how does microwave energy make you hear an audible sound or think, or think you think would make you think you perceive hearing an audible sound? What's the theory behind that? Back to you.
Okay, the frequencies around L-band frequencies, around 1500 megahertz. I think L-band might technically be defined as 1 to 2 gigahertz. So you've got L-band, X-band is around 8.5 to 12.5 gigahertz. There's a bunch of letter designations that were established for security reasons during World War II. And they were classified letters versus frequency allocations during World War II, and they've stuck ever since over the last, let me think, World War II is, 50 years ago, 50-some-odd years ago. So L-band, S-band, X-band, L is around 1 to 2 gigs, C-band is around 2 to 4 gigs, X-band is around 8 to 12 gigs. I don't know what the band number is for 94 gigs, which is the American weaponized thing. When you put a large enough amount of RF energy into a human head, it turns out that brain material has a very high positive temperature coefficient. A part of what goes on when you have a temperature, in other words, your body is running 104 degrees instead of 98, your brain expands. And that's part of the mechanisms by which you can get the various effects, headaches, and whatever. So the pulses of RF energy, if they're strong enough and properly focused in the center of your head, create a very small amount of a micro expansion of the brain material. That's an acoustic shock wave that spreads out to the cranium, to the bone of your head. Your hearing mechanism is inside of that bone and hears that sound. So thermal expansion due to the RF energy.
Repeater, timeout.
So RF energy being absorbed, converted into thermal energy, creating a micro pulse wave of expansion of the brain material, creating an acoustic wave at the hearing system. That's one of the mechanisms by which you can hear sound. There are others. So that's the easiest one to excite, and that was first excited by, can't think of his name right now, a genius of an electrical engineer we had at AIL, who put his head in front of a feed horn of the L-band radar at AIL, an FPS, FPS-8 it was at the time, and he heard a buzzing sound and he reported it in the AIL record, the monthly magazine. And there have been other articles in microwave theory and techniques explaining that exact phenomena. Over to you, Joe, to B2LYY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. Is there any one microwave band or another that would make this more prevalent of it happening to you, or you perceiving something like this happening? That's, I guess, a sub-question, one of them. And the second one was, how much power do you need focused with what type of gain antenna to be able to do this at a given fixed distance? I mean, listening to your formulas that you've said in the past about how power dissipates from a radio transmitting antenna as you get even a few hundred feet away, it's kind of amazing to think you can go put that kind of energy into somebody's head who might be theoretically several hundred feet away from you or more.
The name I was trying to think of is Dr. Eugene Frubini. Dr. Frubini was doing these experiments. He later became a Department of Defense very major person a little bit after World War II, and for a period of time he was an employee of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I worked alongside of him for a couple of days. Quite a character. As you go to higher frequencies, like 94 gigs, you can get extremely fine focusing. You can get the small fractions of 1 degree of beam width. The number of wavelengths across the aperture of your antenna determines the beam width that you can generate. A rough rule of thumb, divide the number of wavelengths of aperture of your antenna into 70 degrees, and that tells you the beam width. If, for instance, I had an antenna that was 70 wavelengths wide, and I divide 70 into 70, I get 1. The antenna would have the capability of generating a 1 degree beam width. Let me drop. That's a very rough rule of thumb, but within a 2-to-1 ratio, it gives you order of magnitude of focusing capability of your radio telescope antenna or your focusing antenna. Human tissue can absorb energy at any frequency. From VHF and above, the tissue of your body, your brain material, your skin, your muscles, very good absorber. You put RF energy into it and a high percentage of it gets turned into heat. So we are very good absorbers. There's no specific frequency. So if you want to do it at L-band or 94 gigs, although your antenna will be very different, the amount of focusing you can do, the amount of range you're going to get, is going to change by those same laws of physics. Let me drop. The energy developed that is dissipated into the brain that will give you sound, the amount that actually gets to your brain only has to be milliwatts. It takes a lot of power at a distance. I mean, it may take megawatt pulses from 400 feet away with your particular antenna in order to make that happen. But what really develops inside of the brain itself is only milliwatts to give you an acoustic sound. There's a lot of inverse square law you're fighting between the distance between the transmitting antenna, the amount of power out of the transmitter, distance, focusing. Are you trying to affect people only on the first floor of the building or the first and the second floor simultaneously? At 94 gigs, you could select whether or not you expose a person's head versus his foot. At 1.5 gigahertz, you don't have anywhere near that amount of focusing capability. You can't get 70 beam width. A 1.5 gig signal has got quite a few inches of, I think it's around 8 inches or so, I can recalculate that, of lambda. So you're not going to get 70 wavelengths on L-band, but getting it at 94 gigs is very easy. Those are some of the variables involved that I think you're asking about, Joe. Sounds like you really like that 60 Minutes program like I did, the V2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And Y2H.
Lou recognized that. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, very good, Dick. Well, of course, because it has to do with RF, and RF has always fascinated me for years and years and years. So it seems like what you're saying, if you had a big enough dish using extremely high frequency microwave, something up to, tens of gigahertz, you could theoretically make a very small beam, focus beam, and that would, I guess it would also increase the gain, the apparent gain of the antenna, would it not?
Oh, wait, yay, literally. There's a direct relationship between gain and beam width. And I'm trying to think now, yes, 30,000. 30,000 is the magic number. Take the horizontal beam width in degrees and the vertical beam width in degrees, multiply them together, divide it into the number 30,000, and you get a rough approximation of the amount of gain as a raw number. Then take the log of that and multiply it by 10, and it'll be decibels of gain. So let me give you an example. Let's assume that I had an antenna with 10 degrees of horizontal beamwidth and 10 degrees of vertical beamwidth. 10 times 10 is 100. 100 divided into 30,000 would be 300. 300 is the gain of your antenna capability with those beamwidths. 300 as a decibels, let's see, the log of 300 times 10, it's around 24 dB of gain. So an antenna with 10 degrees of horizontal and 10 degrees of vertical beamwidth has got around 24 decibels of gain over isotropic. So these are handy rules of thumb. 30,000 and product of beam width divided into it, or number of wavelengths across the aperture divided into 70, giving you the number of degrees of beam width capability. So try to remember these crazy rules of thumb that the people who work day to day with antennas use this, and many of the books don't tell you these secrets, Joe. The B2RYY, let's go over to Lou first. NY2H, K2RIW, go ahead, Lou.
K2RIW, NY2H, good evening. I missed the segment, but I do see it's appears to be on the internet, so I'm going to look at that, certainly. I remember we talked about this a while back, and I think the consensus of opinion on the net was leaning towards mass hysteria. From what I'm hearing now, and again, I haven't seen the segment yet, are we walking that back? Do we think there might be some substance here?
Yeah, the very first complaint of people with health problems was in the Soviet embassy, American citizens, and this was like 40 or so years ago. And whether or not that was real or psychosomatic is in doubt. More recently, you had the situation in Cuba, a small number of people developing various illnesses, and various speculations said that it could be psychosomatic. By way, yes, you could say we're walking it back, we meaning the United States, my impression of what the program seemed to be saying. You've now got a number of embassies, a number of countries, a large number of people with similar sounding related medical problems being investigated by medical experts. It ain't looking psychosomatic anymore. There's too much of it. Now it's time to start saying, what in the world is the technology is there, and the technology is continuously developing, so more and more countries have the ability to buy or build stuff like that as capable, hardware that's capable of doing this. So it's no longer science fiction. It could be real. So it sounds like we're walking it back. We the United States, and the people that were interviewed in that program. And so I hope you get a chance to view that streaming or whatever it is. When you find out how you can get to it, if there's a way you can give us that website, Lou, that would be awful good. NY2H, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, it's www.cbsnews.com/news/is-n-invisible-weapon-targeting-us-diplomats-60-minutes. I don't expect you to have been able to write that down quickly enough, but I think if you just Google it, 60 minutes is what I did. I Googled 60 minutes and ended up finding it pretty readily. And they even have the, extended version, but they talk to the reporters on it for about 5 minutes. So I'll watch that also. But, I feel when I presented this to the net that there was something there, and, you know, I think the reaction was the mass hysteria, but looks like we're going more towards maybe something real. All right, we'll be watching it. So that's it.
KC2GS.
Roy recognized. I'm disappointed that somebody wasn't using some kind of a field strength meter. You can build a very simple field strength meter with a piece of coat hanger wire coming out of the top of your mini box, and diode rectifier inside with a micro ammeter, and that thing could give you broadband, with the right diode in there, that could give you a broadband response from a fraction of a gig to 100 gigs. And so a very simple handheld field strength meter would give you an extremely positive feedback saying that yes, RF energy is existing in this area, and that's got more than enough sensitivity to move that microamp meter. I put the microamp meter long before the power gets high enough to give you these acoustic and other health effects. Roy, ACQGS. The people working in medicine, if they've now got to start analyzing RF exposure maladies, diseases, so to speak, it's going to be tough in the beginning, Roy. Your schools and your apprenticeships, your residence environment is going to have great difficulty at first giving people the right information in this particular area. AC2GS, K2IW. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Yes, Dick. I don't want to be a wet blanket, and I didn't see the 60 Minutes article, but this is kind of exactly how mass hysteria works. It works through the population. The more awareness of it, the more symptoms, and it's a kind of a snowball effect. So, and the government was never walking that walk. They were always xenophobic, they're out to get us type of thing. So I think it's still way up in the air.
Okay, that's an opinion, Roy. When you see the program, you may soften that opinion a little bit, because the program's very well done, and there is evidence that there's something there. Let me see if I listen to myself on 375. On my particular receiver tonight, I sound better there than I do at 85, because 85 is not putting out as much power these days as it used to. And so it's making my full duplex a little bit more difficult to properly adjust. Full duplex means that I can hear what's coming out of the machine. I'm listening to my own voice, if you know what I mean. Therefore, I know when I time out the machine, and I know what words have to be reproduced. What hell of a question you asked us tonight, Joe, to B2RYY. You're spooking some of the people that are listening. Guarantee it. You got it, Joe, K2RYW.
It's just another question that makes the professor enlighten his students who listen.
Do you have any follow-up questions on what you've asked? And at first you made it sound like this is something you just wanted to go into. It's not your original question. Over to you, Joe.
No, it is an original question. It is an original question. I didn't have anything else on my mind. I had something else I was going to ask you about... frequency limits of RF. You can talk about that next week. There'll be an opening next week. Over to the next guy. I don't want to hog the whole thing.
Yeah, when it comes to the frequency limits of RF, my good buddy, I can't think of his name right now. I'm having trouble with names tonight. He always says, with reference to RF, no frequency is high enough. No frequency is too high. When you get up to these super high frequencies, you don't get a nosebleed because you're up that high in frequency. So the higher the frequency, the more the capability. That's part of, you can tell that the 5G cellular telephone systems are going to be specializing in higher and higher frequencies and beam-forming networks, fancier and fancier antennas, and so on. A whole lot of advantages of doing that. Rich is our next guy who signed in, WB2GXM. Golf X-ray Mike, if I got it right, Rich. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
K2RIW on the group. This is Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-ray Mike, Rich. Out of respect for Rich N2EO, I could swap slots with him.
No, why swap? You signed in. You were the second person who signed in. You're entitled to ask your question. Go right ahead. Rich number one, WB3GXM. You got it, Rich number one.
Okay, just feeling mellow. The newest ARRL book coming out is a 320-page tome talking about current generation uses of energy. And they mention a heat pump. Now, until I wake up the scratch to buy this book, what is a heat pump? And what is an example of a heat pump? WB2GXM.
Let me think now, roughly 1970, is that when he did it? Richard Hodder, a good engineer at AIL, installed a heat pump in his house in Eaton's Neck. He built an A-frame house in Eaton's Neck as a kit. It was a kit house you could buy from the Stanford company, as I remember. A ski chalet. Okay. Your refrigerator is a heat pump. It pumps heat from the inside of the refrigerator box to the outside, to the coils on the outside. It's a one-way heat pump. When you install that kind of equipment in a house, I'm not talking about a refrigerator now, I'm just talking about your furnace for the house, so to speak. That's where the word heat pump is usually used. If I've got a great big, condenser, yes, condenser on the outside of the house and evaporator coils inside the house, that's an air conditioning system for the house. If I can then reverse the flow and use things backwards so that the coils outside the house become the evaporator and the coils inside the house become the condenser, I can now take heat from outside the house and pump it into the house, use it in reverse. Sometimes those coils outside are really buried in the ground, sometimes they're part of a irrigation or watering system, go down to a well, so to speak. But even though the temperature outside might be 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and you want your house to be 72 degrees Fahrenheit, you're pumping that heat uphill, and a heat pump will do that for you. Your refrigerator is pumping heat up also uphill. You're trying to run your...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Temperature of your... And the temperature outside of your refrigerator might be 72 degrees. So you're pumping heat uphill again. So a air conditioning-like system, depending in which direction you're flowing it, is either a refrigerator, an air conditioner, or a heating system. But the usual heat pump, properly designed for a house, when those words are used with reference to the furnace air conditioning slash system for a house, the word heat pump means it's air conditioning in the summertime and heating in the wintertime. In theory, it could be very efficient, more efficient than buying oil or gas, and certainly a lot more efficient than direct I2R heating. So, air conditioning, refrigeration-like systems, properly used, gives you a heat pump. It's an engineering paradise because in the early days, they weren't super reliable. My buddy Dick Hotter had to be tinkering with that every month, so to speak, to keep it in good operating condition. There's always something that, some component that needed replacement and so on. They weren't well designed way back when we dropped it. When he first installed that in 1968 or so, they were not well designed. I am guessing the heat pumps you can buy these days are a lot more reliable. Guarantee if you Google the word heat pump, you'll find a lot of information on this one, Rich. Is that the B2GXM? And where did you first hear about it? K2RIW in the TechNet.
And
to
wheel with information.
The heat pump is mentioned in the blurb in the advertisement for the ARRO book. So it sounds interesting, especially with Con Edison having everyone under their thumb, WB2JXM.
Okay, Rich number two said he's got some information on this. N2EO, K2IW. Go ahead with your information, Rich.
You wouldn't use them up here. I don't think they put up out enough hot, enough heat. In Florida, they're very popular because you can use in winter and an air conditioner in the summer. It's more common there.
And now, I agree with you, Rich. More common in Florida than they are in New York. They do exist in New York, but they're a little bit rare. Florida having generally warmer temperatures, like for instance, the average temperature of Florida in the month of April gets as low as 67 degrees and as high as 85 degrees as a sort of an average for the day. So a Florida day, and you have a lot higher temperatures. Therefore, using it for heating in the so-called wintertime is a lot easier in Florida. Although when you want your heat pump to do air conditioning, it's going to be a lot more efficient in New York than Florida. because to do air conditioning, you've got to take the heat out of the house and pump it uphill. You might want your house to be at 68 degrees Fahrenheit under air conditioning, and the outside temperature might be 85. So the heat pump is going to work better for heating in Florida, but better for air conditioning in New York. Pays your money, you take your choice. But how well it's popular in Florida versus New York is not only a function of local weather conditions. Another big variable is how well it's advertised in that particular area. What is the? Let me drop this. Also, what's the philosophy of the people? You maybe have a higher average age, more mature people in Florida, retirees, and they think very differently than the people in New York, where there's a much smaller percentage of retirees. Maybe the average age of New Yorkers is a lower number than the average age of Floridians. People make a joke that Florida is the Lord's waiting room. So I'm probably not wording it correctly, but you probably heard versions of that joke. Okay, let's see if that's was that, did we answer enough of your question? And guarantee if you Google the word heat pump, Rich number one, GXM, you'll find a lot more to this. WB2GXM for any final questions, K2LAW, for the TechNet.
What's that heat pump?
Sam, we'll get to you in a second. GXM, first, go ahead.
Actually, I think I have enough to get started, and this quote looks very interesting. It might actually pay for itself with all the various topics they discuss. And thank you, WB2GXM.
The book that you're thinking about buying, what's the title of that book and what's the price? I think you said it's an ARRL book. Over to you, Rich number one.
Well, I'm kind of laid out right now. I'm not going to go look for the title, but it's the very latest book, and it is 320 pages, and it's about current ways of generating and using energy, both electric and temperature. K2RW in the group, WB2GXO.
Okay, we've got two people standing by with comments. The first one, I think, is Sam. Mr. SAM? K2RW, go ahead.
T1SAM. I put in a system a couple of years ago, mainly for air conditioning, but for supplemental heating. And it works pretty well. It limits down to about 0 degrees. Once it drops below zero, it's not efficient enough to give off any heat. But other than that, it works very good as supplemental heating. I have heat, obviously, but it works pretty good.
Very fine, Sam. When you get down to very cold temperatures outside, like near 0 degrees, your evaporator coil outside has to run colder than the air temperature in order to suck heat out of that local air, to pump it uphill, to pump it into your house. And one of the things that, if your humidity is anything above 10%, that super cold evaporator coil outside will eventually ice up. So I think the icing condition on a cold day is part of the reason why a heat pump on a 0 degree day Fahrenheit does not work very well. I wonder if you've ever experienced any freeze up of your coil on a cold day. Over to you, Sam. KC1SAM, K2RIW.
It could be, but at that point it's too cold to go out and look at it. So I'm fairly sure. It just senses it and it shuts down.
Okay, so it's sensing the, if I understand you correctly, it is sensing the fact that the icing has occurred. My buddy Dick Hotter, with the system he installed in roughly 1968 in Eaton's Neck, he would have to periodically reverse the thing in order to create some heating to melt the ice so that the water would drip away from those coils outside, and then he goes back to the heating cycle. So the system had to periodically do that. And pretty soon the frequency of doing the heating cycle to get rid of the ice starts becoming too high a percentage, and you're not getting very much heating anymore. The person who said comment, I wonder if that was Ed. Go ahead, the comment person, give us your call letters and name. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2GJE, Ed.
They installed a system on this old house in the New England area, but they had to drill a well that was quite deep, and I think that was the most expensive part of the system, over.
Yeah, the portion, the kind of a heat pump that uses a well is capable of a lot more efficiency, and your well is never going to, the water deep in the ground in your well is never going to go to freezing temperatures. So therefore, there is no longer a limitation. In other words, any outdoor temperature, your heat pump will work. If your heat sink for the system, the outdoor heat sink, is a well. And that's the efficient way of doing it. But yes, the right installation of the well that's capable of running a heat pump is a expensive installation. It's a very fancy kind of well. The cooling that was being used for the HBO ground station in Hopog, Long Island, which is now in the process of being closed down because it's redundant, was using that kind of a system. It was, what was it now? No, they were using well water for heat sink. Their problem is their traveling wave tubes give off a tremendous number of watts of heat that has to be dissipated, and they were dissipating it in a local well. So that wasn't a heat pump. When those guys at the HBO station, all they had to do is take heat coming off the traveling wave tubes and run it through some kind of a air heat exchanger system, and it would easily heat the building in the wintertime. In the summertime, the air conditioning was more difficult, so the well water was used for...
K2UPS.
Rich recognized the well water was used for the heat sink for the traveling wave tubes, as well as the heat sink for the air conditioning system. Rich, K2UPS, I wonder if you've ever considered putting a heat pump into your house, and maybe you've got something like a heat pump in some of your very fancy trucks. K2UPS, K2LAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick, and that's KTUPS Mobile. I just wanted to confirm that the title of that book is Energy Choices for the Radio Amateur, and it's, I think, $29.95 from the league. I did look into the heat pump or geothermal at one point, but the one problem we have on Long Island is with high electricity rates, so it makes some of these modes and methods of heating and cooling not as enticing for us as it does to people in other areas of the country. But you're correct, the heat pump won't work well below certain temperatures. But if you either use well, you know, deep well, or geothermal to heat cool, that's one way to get around it. But the electricity to run the motors is the issue here. Now, if you back it up with solar, can maybe offset some of the electricity costs, that I might make it a little more cost effective. But I haven't installed any at my place. Go ahead.
Very fine. And thank you for the information, Rich. KTUPS and the KTUIW at the group, the TechNet group. You said you're mobile. We're always curious, where are you mobile tonight? I'm going to make a guess in Pennsylvania. And I'm simply making that guess because you spend a lot of hours going to and from Pennsylvania as you go out to the Midwest with your trips. And I'm also noticing that the audio has a slightly peculiar characteristic tonight. I wonder if you're using an unusual method of getting your audio to us. The audio sounds a little bit, I can't come up with a good word for it, but your voice becomes slightly modified. I can easily recognize your voice, but still it's got this other artifact in there. KTUPS, how are you getting to us, and where are you located? You got it, Rich.
KTUPS, well, I disconnected the phone charger. I don't know, maybe there was a hum coming in or something like that, but I'm using the same headset phone that I've always used. I don't know what's causing that, but I'm still in Ohio. North East Ohio, just about getting ready to cross into West Virginia on the way back to New York from Kentucky.
Yeah, you disconnected the charger, and that's not it. the audio itself has got a slightly peculiar characteristic to it. It's not quite the same high fidelity. The methods by which you get the audio back to us is, by my standards, a very circuitous route, depending on where you're located. I think the local hardware, I am guessing your cell phone is the first step of the trip. You're talking by cell phone into a local cell site, I think, which is then going into the internet. So each time you connect to the internet, it can be a different kind of a connection. Each cell site base station has got different hardware, so that will give you some of the variation. I'm making a bunch of guesses as to how your audio is getting to us. Correct me on some of this, though, Rich. KTUPS, KTULIW, and the TechNet.
It initiates in the Bluetooth headset, so then it's going wirelessly from the headset to the cell phone, and the cell phone obviously wireless out to the cell site to access data. I haven't changed the cell phone or the headset, that was something different. I'm not really sure what it would be, unless it is coming from the local cell site itself.
Very fine, Rich. Okay, so wireless headset, your local cell phone, that in turn talking into, I guess that's Bluetooth. Bluetooth or, I can't think of the name of the other. ZigBee? No, it's not ZigBee, it's Bluetooth. Bluetooth from your wireless headset to your cell phone on its frequency to the local cell site, that into the internet. If you were in the right location, could you have been using Echolink, where you're using a ham radio frequency into a local ham repeater site, and then Echolink to get back to us? Have you ever talked to us on Echolink? Could you, if you wanted to bad enough, in certain locations? Obviously, the coverage would not be as anywhere near as complete as it is with the technique you're using right now. KTUPS, K2LIW.
KTUPS, it would be possible to access Echolink via... near 440 radio, but you have to go through a repeater that had Echolink on it. Well, I've never done it that way. I've only done it through my cell phone. So I can't vouch for how easy that is. Certainly the range would not be as good. I drive out of range of it. On the cell site, I can listen to the whole 4 hours and then I'm in trouble.
Yeah, right now, another characteristic I notice is that the volume of your audio goes up and down in a strange way. I've seen that quite often on certain cell phone, cell site combinations. The volume goes up and down. It's like an automatic gain control system that's running a little bit crazy. The conversation we're having right now, the techniques you're using as you drive at 60 miles an hour in Ohio going into West Virginia, and while you're mobile in motion, talking to us from 1,000 miles away, this kind of a discussion on ham radio frequencies 40 years ago, when you and I were cutting our teeth in the ham radio, would be considered crazy. No one would have anticipated any of this jazz. So, although the major system that we care about ham radio-wise is RF, radio frequency, boy, there's a lot of other digital techniques involved. Let me drop this. I'm guessing that your voice is being digitized with all kinds of crazy latency by way of your cell phone and the way it gets into the internet and so on, and then it has to be de-digitized in order to convert from digital back to analog audio in order for us to hear what's coming out the other end. Great stuff. Okay, let's see. I think Rich N2EO had a question. N2EO. Called you Rich number 2. We're just going to call you N2EO. N2EO, go right ahead with your question for the night, Rich. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, this N2EO. You know, I'm moving to, which is, hold on. Manaville is not far from, it's in the same town. What he calls the, laboratory, the Brookhaven Laboratory. The town is located in the same town as called Brookhaven. When I go there, I'm going to be lonely. go. Patty doesn't want to go. I think it's better. Wait. I know dumb questions pop up all the time. Dumb questions. Every day. I hope somebody listening to me, once I get to Manorville, could introduce me to a guy for the one. Not quite that. A nice lady. I'll be 69 next month. I'd like to meet a lady. 59, 60, that area. I'm a heavy smoker. So if a lady doesn't like smoking, when I'm with her, she's in my house. I don't have to smoke. I'm a gentleman, and I just wanted to take her out to dinner. I'm just going to dinner. What do you think?
Brookhaven National Laboratory is located in Upton, New York. UPTON is the name of the town, which I think is the adjacent town to Manorville. So it's not exactly the same town, Upton versus Manorville. And when it comes to people as mature as you and I are, Rich, that's a detriment. The number of people you can find as a companion at that age is drastically decreased as opposed to a companion if you were, and you and I were 25 years of age. The heavy smoking is another strong detriment that you already sense. And the health reasons as well as companion reasons, giving up the smoking, as difficult as it might be, is something worth trying. I know it's going to be the 10th time you've tried to give it up. But the combination of cigarettes and age and a new resident of Manorville, that's a difficult combination. When you try to find a companion under those conditions, be warned ahead of time. You're looking for a very rare bird that can tolerate them. Your amount of smoking, your age, your new location, and so on. And the number of people in Manorville, there may not be a person like that. And we're not talking about a person willing to move to Manorville. So I'm not trying to discourage you. I'm just trying to let you know. I think it's a long shot, Rich. What you're seeking is going to be very, very difficult. That's an opinion. I might be wrong. Let's hope I'm wrong. N2EO, T2RIW, the TechNet.
I know, Dick. I'm hoping somebody here listening might know somebody. Everybody knows other people, and they know people.
Okay, by way of the transmission you just made, the word is out what you're looking for. I think I've got down the list of everyone who checked in. Let me stand by to make sure. Did I skip anybody by mistake? K2RIW in the TechNet listening for anybody I may have skipped.
Cameron, this is WA2SAY.
WA2SAY. K2RIW. 2SAY. Sounds like Doug. Haven't heard from you in a while, Doug. You're sounding very good tonight. I guess you're coming in. I'm making a guess you're coming in through the Telden repeater. I hope you had a chance to see 60 Minutes tonight, the first section on this radio frequency biohazard 20-minute presentation of 60 Minutes. I hope you had a chance to see it. It's an eye-opener. And it looks like people complaining of these health effects in the embassies in various countries throughout the world. It's beginning to look stronger and stronger, like these are not just psychosomatic and, if you know what I mean, these are not crazy people. There might be something really going on there. I wonder if you had a chance to see that. If not, do go to the website and see it. W-A-2-S-A-Y in Rocky Point, I'm guessing. K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Doug.
It's Dick. I am in Rocky Point. And no, I didn't see the program, but I will see if I can find it. Be interesting. Yes, I have been reading occasionally in the paper about the possibility of some kind of radiation or something into the various embassies. I thought I would. I had emailed you about a question about a an electronics plant. It was at one time in Great River, and I don't know if you ever had any insight into that, but now we have a group of people listening here to me tonight. I wonder if anybody remembers the name of a fairly good-sized electronics place in Great River.
I may be wrong, Doug, but I know that the Grumman Information Systems did have a division in Great River, and maybe they took over another company. In fact, in Great River, there was a field day group, a group of ham radio operators that would operate from the Great River location. I remember being out there once where they were using a cherry picker-like thing. So, does anybody know the name of the electronic company that was in Great River, which eventually, I think, became a division of Grumman Information Systems, I think. Anybody know the name of that company in Great River? That's what Doug wants to know. Give us your call letters right now. K2IW on the TechNet.
Where a company took over a building that been using, and Grumman decided they didn't need it anymore, but I'm not sure. I know that somehow, but that was the building. Actually, it was two buildings each other. Grumman was involved with it at some point in time, either before or after, but there. I worked a year or so, and but it's driving me crazy. On the Google Maps, I can't even see the building. I'm down. WA2SAY, back to net.
Yeah, it's sad the way everything changes. We can't keep track of things very easily anymore, Doug. So even the buildings were torn down. As I remember, there was a lot of land, not very many buildings. Ooh. Donna McGowan. The Donna McGowan Antenna Company was... No, maybe that's not them. Any some chance it was Donna McGowan Antenna Company, Doug, W2SAY, K2IW?
It wasn't Donna and McGowan, that much I know. Although they did do some antenna work, they had a nice open field range, as a matter of fact. They had about 700 foot or something like that antenna range over grass. And a nice tower at each end. Very, very, very well put together. And we did some 10 gigahertz antenna work at that point, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you and I, as we age, have problems with forgetfulness. We forget the names of the employees we worked with, even if they may have been my roommate. I forget some of those names. I find other people have the problem, too. But this is a slightly more serious version of it, Doug, where you worked for the company for a short period of time. You don't remember the name. You worked for them for what, roughly a year and a half or so, Doug? Go ahead.
Probably about right. It wasn't a heck of a long time. We did, I can't tell you the name of the thing we worked on because it was classified secret, and I don't know whether even though it was pretty close to 40 years ago, I don't know whether that classification still holds or not, but it was a wideband receiving system. It worked from 1 gigahertz to 12.4 gig.
Now, you said you worked for them 40 years ago in Great River. Was that before you came to AIL? Let me think now. I remember seeing you at AIL. That's like a year. 1970-ish, which would be 49 years ago. So, was your Great River experience after your AIL experience, Doug? Go ahead.
It was after AIL, and it was after Republic Electronic Industries. I went to AIL, I went to REIC. REIC had a layoff, and I went to this company, whatever it was, and I remember... I had a gadget that I had developed invented, I guess I should say, at REIC. And I remember I went to an interview at the